such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., along with the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my pleasure to be sitting in, along with my co-host, Loretta Frelick, as we do on most Mondays, for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. Loretta, how was your weekend?
Awesome, Mary.
Good.
Awesome.
Good.
How about you?
It was good. We had a birthday in the house, and I have another kid who can now vote, which terrifies me. we decided that our votes would cancel each other's out. So at least we've got that caveat going. But we had a nice weekend and a nice little family birthday party and beautiful weather. So it was a great weekend to be in Chicago if you weren't near Lollapalooza. So which you cannot pay me to go to. I don't understand the appeal. I really don't.
I don't either. I really don't.
What about
standing out in the hot sun, sweating to death with millions of other people?
Right, I know, with no masks on.
To hear bands nobody's ever heard of.
Right.
But
yes.
They have.
Yes,
they
okay,
hear.
They have apparently. So, well, last week was kind of a very busy week in Catholic journalism. We had a couple of stories break, both rather unpleasant topics. So if you have little ears near the radio, I would suggest that you turn it off and go back and listen to the podcast later, because we're going to be dealing with some adult topics and some of a sensitive nature. And if you have little ones around or in the car, you can always listen to the podcast. Last week, we had two stories. First of all, the former Cardinal McCarrick has been criminally charged in Massachusetts with the abuse of a 16-year-old boy that happened, I believe, 3 decades ago while he was celebrating a wedding at Wellesley College. And it's kind of an interesting thing in Massachusetts criminal law code that if it is the sexual abuse of a minor, if the abuser is not from Massachusetts, once he or she leaves the state, the statute of limitations clock stops ticking. And so therefore, they were, even though Cardinal McCarrick is now 91 years old, they were able to criminally charge him with the sexual abuse of this minor. So it'll be interesting to see how that all works out. I understand he is not in good health, but he does have an arraignment date, I believe, sometime next week. Loretta, how quickly would something like that move through the court system? Or does that vary state by state, too?
Well, I think it varies by each district. So in Cook County, it can go quickly.
Yeah.
You know, and it can go, it can move slow. I know that I used to want my victim to be really whole. And so
right.
I would work hard with our victim witness people, who in Cook County are the unsung heroes
right.
of the Justice Department. But I would make sure that they were getting counseling and getting, you know, I guess the most important thing, and I really think this speaks to the seminarians and
right.
the other boys that are now young men that were abused, a victim begins to heal once they are believed.
Right.
And so as traumatic as it is to come and tell their story to people, it is good for them to know that authorities have believed them
right.
and are taking it forward. And so it could be, you know, if the person wants to get it over, they'll move it through the system with a good attorney.
Right.
If they're going to go to trial and claim it did not happen, you sometimes like to make sure you've got your victim in a really good place, because they will not only have to testify in an open courtroom, but they will also have to be cross-examined.
Right.
And so that's what you try and prepare them for. And I've had some really amazing things happen with victims that really just show me that they have crossed over.
Good.
And yeah,
good,
so it's good, a really good,
yeah,
good thing.
Well, but, and it's a point of closure, especially so many years later for this particular victim. But the other big story to break came from an outlet called The Pillar, which is a fairly new Catholic media outlet run by two canon lawyers, J.D. Flynn and Ed Condon, who were formerly with CNA, Catholic News Association, I believe, and EWTN's newspaper source. And they broke a story about a priest, Monsignor Jeffrey Burrell, who was the general secretary of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops' offices, which means, in essence, he is the highest ranking priest in the United States who is not a bishop. And their investigative journalism uncovered that Monsignor Burrell has been using an app on his phone called Grindr, which is used by men in the gay community to connect for anonymous sex with other men in the gay community. And Monsignor Burrell stepped down after this story broke. The evidence was made known to the Bishop's Conference in advance, the story broke. And there have been, oddly enough, the reaction to this, I was a bit surprised by this, has come more from media, both Catholic media and secular media, questioning the journalistic ethics of printing this story in the first place and gathering the information. So I went to the person who I thought could help unpack this with us best, and that is Chicago Sun-Times investigative reporter Robert Hergeth, who has covered all sorts of issues, not only abuse issues within the church, but also different kinds of crime and justice issues. He covers Metro Chicago and police and some crime issues, and has graciously agreed, even though he's on vacation with his family, to come on with us to help us analyze this. Bob has also taught journalism ethics for many years, most recently at Loyola University. So, Bob, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Loretta and I are really grateful that you're giving your time. So,
especially you, Bob, with such an incredible background with the Sun-Times.
Yeah.
We are really delighted that you're sharing your knowledge and your expertise.
Yeah. Bob, were you surprised by sort of the reaction to this story in the same way that I was?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I think I was just more, I mean, it's a fascinating story, you know, a few different ways if you look at it. First of all, because it brings in this sort of digital, you know, component that,
right,
that I think a lot of people fully don't grasp how much, you know, our digital footprint is out there, and maybe even forever, no matter what we're looking at or
right,
visiting or whatever. And so there's that digital component that just, I just think that is just so intriguing and scary in some ways. And then it also brings in sort of these kind of quote unquote culture war issues. And then, and it's, this is a startup. And again, it's, you know, yes, it's, religious media as opposed to secular media, but also, you know, there are so many sort of startup, online media sources that are, operating now and breaking news in a terrain that used to be dominated only by a few. So just, you know, not speaking to the facts of this case, but just that, just sort of as a backdrop, was sort of interesting to me. And I've been thinking about this, you know, a lot, just because I do cover religion, not from a beat perspective, but from an investigative perspective. And I've been writing about for 6 months, almost nothing but child sex abuse within the Catholic Church, primarily the religious orders for the Sun-Times. So, you know, it is interesting to me, and I'm not, I mean, I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised just because, I mean, there is such a division within the church and within culture, our society to begin with, about sexual issues, and frankly, media,
right,
that, you know, this blowing up is sort of like, well, I mean, that's just sort of the nature of things these days, I think.
Right.
You know, Bob, we at the state's attorney's office used to have a phrase that was dance like no one's looking, but text and email like it's going to be read in open court. So
right.
I am stunned that this is an issue. I really am. I don't understand why people think that there's some sort of ethical problem in bringing what's out there. I mean, the whole point of being on Grindr is, and for this gentle ears, is to hook up with other males for anonymous sex. So why would, if that's your goal and you're trying to get the attention of someone, why would you think that there's some sort of right to privacy there? Right. That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure. Like, I can't imagine, and Bob, maybe you could speak to this a little bit as well, that he would have, that the priest in question would have assumed he had a right to privacy because, you know, I know a lot of people, including people in my own family that do IT security for a living, who tell me no one really should have an expectation of privacy, not just with this particular app, but with many of the apps that you use on your phone.
Absolutely.
Right? So, Bob, what do you think about just, let's just kind of speak about it generically. If information, and I know your paper, secular papers, would look at this story differently than Catholic media would look at it because there's different, I guess, priorities and interests of the readers that are operative there. But in terms of like when, you know, this kind of information becomes available, what are the general ground rules that when you're teaching journalism ethics, you would teach to your students?
Well, I mean, I've got a couple quick caveats. First of all, you know, I can't really speak to, you know, this specific case because
right.
I don't know enough, but, you know, and, you know, but a couple of quick observations with that caveat, you know, and again, speaking generally also, if somebody's alleged to have abused children, to me that's, you know, I mean, that's abhorrent and horrible, obviously, you know, and, you know, the game is on, you know, anything, you know, reporting wise, you know, I feel, you know, there's no holding back in terms of doing a story. You know, this, to me, this is, unless I'm missing something here, this is different, you know, because,
right.
Well, first of all, as they said in the story, and again, I don't know this priest. I don't know, you know, I know basically what I've read and then sort of on my end, how I do business. That's what I know. So forgive me if anything is omitted here.
No,
but,
you know,
what they're doing is writing within, you know, the church perspective.
Right. A context and of a, yeah.
And so this is a, you know, quote unquote, you know, crime within the church rules and the church law. Right. But from a secular perspective, at least as far as I know, it's not being, you know, that, you know, these were presumably consenting adults. And frankly, it's not even necessarily, I mean, the presumption is this guy did this because of the data, but I mean, it's, you know, there is still, they didn't connect things 100%. It's, you know, they connected, I believe, the phone and the app data
right.
with his location. So yeah, presumably it's, and, but that's not, you know, 100% linked unless he's acknowledged something I'm not aware of. But, you know, so there is that sort of, you know, this is not a clean situation in terms of the connecting the data. But it's, you know, from them, it's a church, you know, they write from a church perspective. Me, I write from a secular perspective. So, you know, if there's not a crime committed, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean I wouldn't write a story. But, you know, I was very uncomfortable with the wording, just reading it, just from a fairness perspective, I really, you know, the two sort of guiding principles in journalism ethics for me, you know, and that I convey and that I try to live is, you know, fairness and accuracy.
Okay.
You know, and that's just the baseline. And, you know, the Society of Professional Journalists, they have, you know, which is like sort of the trade professional group or for journalists, you know, they don't regulate journalism, but they guide. And there is an SPJ code of ethics that I actually have taught, you know, I've conveyed to my, you know, journalism students for years, you know, and
right.
also that I try to live by, and that makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, so there is that, you know, sort of, you know, guiding principle. And so the way that they wrote the story, I mean, right in the, at least in the initial story, I don't have it in front of me, but my recollection is it said something to the effect of sexual misconduct.
Right.
And then later it said illicit behavior or whatever it said. And it's like, you know, that bothered me because it implied something. It may not, it may imply something within a, you know, religious context, which what they were maybe trying to convey, because, but from a broader context and from a secular context, it, to me, it implies something that is not, you know, was not correct. I mean,
yeah.
me, when I heard that, I thought children. And then
right,
I looked
right.
at it and it wasn't. So I don't know. So again, I don't know.
Yeah, there was like a conflation, wasn't there? Like you have the behavior, the use of this app, and from what the various sources, you know, since the story broke, have indicated is that the app apparently was used during working hours, and so, you know, presumably on work time. You have the use of that app, but then later in the story, it does seem to kind of veer off into conflating that with the app being used to abuse minors, and there seems to be no evidence of that. And they do say that kind of early on in the story that there's no evidence that but then they went on to talk about abuse of minors anyway. I guess that's where my concern came in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, is there, you know, it's, there is a segment, you know, I mean, because I write about, you know, sex abuse in the context of the church, so I know that there is a segment of people that, you know, kind of, you know, linked it to homosexuality with child abuse, when that's not, you know, that's not the case,
right.
You know,
and right.
So, and yet, you know, so that, and that's not,
right.
You know,
and,
fair.
Yeah, and I think that's, yeah, what some of the gay press, the LGBTQ publications were saying, that, you know, we as gay men are not necessarily child abusers, and just because you are gay does not make you any more predisposed to abusing children. And so I think that that's where they're, you know, some of the stories I read, I don't regularly read that press, but that seemed to be a, you know, and I think a fair enough concern on their part.
You know, but I think as you read the article, the Pillar is investigating, you know, they're alleging that he engaged in serial and illicit sexual activity. As a priest, to have any sexual contact with anybody is wrong, and is not faithfully living out your vocation of priesthood. And certainly in the position in which he ascended to and obviously agreed to, sure, I'll be the general secretary for the USCCB. I mean, his conduct mocks the faith. It mocks the bishops who he signed on. He could have said, you know what, no, I would prefer not to do this job. You know, please find someone else. But he is the one that signed on to serve, and he knew what the duties he was to perform. So he mocks the faith by his conduct. And so I think that's what Catholics are concerned about.
Well, and I guess, you know, having worked for the church all the years that I did, I know that there were heterosexual people held to the same standards when there was something in their personal life. If this was a person who was considered what we would have called a public minister in the church, and there was something about their private life that they were living in a reckless way, that could be grounds for termination. But Bob, in your world as a secular reporter and editor and teacher of journalist ethics, that wouldn't necessarily overlap.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess how to answer this. I mean, it's, you know, I understand the church, obviously, you know, on this issue, on the issue of sexuality, and, you know, and I acknowledge that is sort of the rule and the standard, right?
Right.
But that's for others to decide, you know.
Bob, how would you have done this story better? How would you have taken what we now know with the Beryl resigning, and based on all the information, how would you have done the story better? Or is that an unfair question?
No, I mean, you can ask me whatever. I'm not sure I would have done the story. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know enough, you know, about, you know, their, I mean, it's in starting with how they got the data and what the data actually is.
Right.
To me, from a journalism perspective, and one of the reasons I'm talking to you guys is not because I'm here to wag a finger at anybody. That's not my position. That's
and
not
we're not
my,
asking you,
know,
you
my,
to.
My, oh, no, totally. And, you know, but that's just not, you know, who I am. But because you're talking about, you know, this topic is so interesting because, you know, of the, from a journalism standpoint, because of the data, where do they get it? What exactly is it? And the answer is, I don't really know.
Yeah,
so without that full knowledge, I can't judge, you know, whether I'd use it, how I do it, but it's fascinating to look at and looking at whether this is the frontier of, you know, sort of, you know, this sort of surveillance, aspect, you know, entering more and more into journalism.
Right.
And I think that there is, I mean, there's always, you know, so it's worth a discussion, a deeper discussion. So I would just be fascinated, you know, in learning more about the origins of it. And, you know, did somebody, they got this commercially available. It's like, well, what is that to me? And again, if they explain that in more deeper ways,
which they haven't yet, seen,
then I apologize. But I have not seen the explanation other than it's commercially available. And then also, well, okay, it's commercially available. That syncs up to certain addresses or phones or whatever it is. But it's like, well, how did they, you know, get that IP address or whatever the sort of, you know, identifiers were from there. I don't know enough about that, but
what would the ground rules be, just, you know, generally speaking, for how, like, I know, for example, your paper, the Chicago Sun-Times, did an investigation with a fake tavern called the Mirage, very cleverly named.
I never hit a drink there.
So plenty of others did, apparently. Bob, can you kind of, like, let's use that as an example, because again, as you've alluded to earlier, we're in a little bit of the Wild Wild West now because of this electronic data being so easily accessible. Like I said, you know, I talked to somebody who does IT security who just kind of laughed and said no one should have an expectation of privacy using that app. And it indicated to him that the person was being very reckless, because that apparently is, you know, I wasn't aware myself, although, you know, I have some sense of it, that it was that easy to figure out where somebody was. But let's go to your Mirage case, because I think that's maybe a good sort of teaching case that you could walk our listeners through to talk about, you know, what's entrapment, what isn't. When is it fair game to try and obtain information? When isn't it? Et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. Sure. Well, just quick primer for those who don't know what the Mirage was. Back in, was it the 70s? The Sun, way before my time, in our time. You know, the Sun-Times, with a couple of media partners, you know, purchased a tavern, ran it with reporters to basically see what would happen in terms of inspectors coming in, soliciting bribes, and all the while, things were being recorded. There were photographers behind, like, one-way glass and stuff like that, and capturing it, and ended in a huge explosive expose that got a lot of people fired. I forget if people went to prison, but it was, you know, it just showed how Chicago worked at the time. And my recollection was it was up for the Pulitzer Prize that year or that next year, and it was sort of a, but it didn't win because there was concerns about the media becoming the news and fueling the news as opposed to reporting the news.
Right.
And so it didn't win the Pulitzer, and my recollection, that was led by the editor of the Washington Post at the time. But anyway, so, you know, I think I'd explain it this way, that every case is a little bit different. You know, so I think every case, every story, a potential story has to be judged on its own merits and thought through and talked through, you know, responsibly. And, like, this is where also the SPJ Code of Ethics comes in, where it's like, well, okay, you know, I mean, not that, I'm not going to pretend the reporters sit there and refer to it all the time, but you sort of, after a while, you just sort of understand what it's all about. And so A, every case is sort of unto itself and has to be judged by itself. But B, there definitely are sort of, in my opinion, you know, reasons to depart from what's kind of the norm. Sometimes, if the circumstances, you know, depending on the circumstances, like, for instance, the Mirage, like, that was definitely not the norm. And did the reporters insert themselves into the story? Well, yeah, but that was also the only way to really get at that story.
Okay.
So I think there are times to do that, but I just want to be very clear. I'm not, in saying that, making an excuse that in this instance with the pillar, that was the right thing to do, because there are also, you know, there are also times when journalists can be over the top. And like I said, I do, just in terms of some of the wording and in that story and in the mention of sexual misconduct from a religious perspective, where somebody could misinterpret that as, you know, without defending the guy, without knowing anything, I interpreted it a different way upon reading it, you know, than I think.
Right. Well, so how do you deal with it at the paper? So let's just assume, and again, we don't know how the pillar got the information. And we don't know whether or not they paid for it, or this was something that just kind of was dropped in an envelope on somebody's desk, which does happen from time to time. I mean, you know that as an investigator.
Sure, all the time.
You've said that to me in conversations before, that this happens all the time, that people tip off reporters, that they receive, you know, anonymous packs of information. What would sort of the standard way be of handling, say, an explosive story with pictures and details and stuff lands on your desk one day in a brown manila envelope and you open it? What would be the way you would normally proceed?
Well, I mean, you know, we do get stuff, and sometimes is it stolen? I mean, maybe. You know, right. You know. I mean, look at the Pentagon Papers, if you recall that.
Sure.
I mean, they were, you know, they that was one of the biggest stories, one of the most important stories of the past, you know, 50 years, and it was, or 50 years plus, and, or I forget. But, you know, and were those stolen? Yeah. And were they printed? Yeah, they were printed. So, I mean, you know, where something comes from does not necessarily, you know, is, you know, like, oh, that's stolen, we're not going to use it. It's like, well, no, that's not the standard. The standard is it newsworthy? You know, is it... You know, and then, like I said, every situation has to be examined on its own footing, you know, within the contours and context of, you know, libel law, you know.
And stuff like that.
So it would not, just because, you know, not, you know, it's important, though, let's say we do get something on our desk, you know, it's also important to know where it comes from. And know that it's so. If we got a picture of, you know, some compromising something or other, I don't even know what. You know, it's like, well, is it real? I mean, you know, I mean, that's a question that every journalist has to kind of just break down to the foundational level. Like, is this legit? You know, just because there's a recording of something, a record of something, a photo of something, doesn't make it real. There is such a thing as Photoshop. So I mean, everything has to be validated just to make sure it's true. Because there are, you know, there are scams out there and problems and setups. And so you just, you know, this boils down to the accuracy and the fairness. And then at that level, once it's accurate, you know, get a judge whether it's, you know, whether it's worth writing about.
Right.
And, you know, so, and from my perspective, you know, that's, you know, I try to make that, you know, kind of a high bar. I mean, there's so many things I could write about on a daily basis that just, it doesn't rise to my, what I regard as my standard. And I don't want me to sound like, you know, like, oh, I'm so important, you know, but it's just, there's a lot of things out there, and, you know, we all have to make judgments about what's newsworthy, what's writing about, what's worth our time, because there's so few of us and so many things to write about out there.
Yeah. And has your job gotten harder in that respect, more difficult because of things like, you know, Photoshop didn't really exist 15 years ago, and, you know, this data mining and all of this stuff, does that make when you're trying to verify, whatever has landed on your desk, say anonymously, someone gives you a tip just for the sake of argument, has this new technology, is it more difficult? And like, how do you just as a reporter keep up with all the changes?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, is it more difficult? I went to a conference a couple of years ago, pre-COVID, for a trade group for investigative reporters, and they talked about, you know, phony photos.
Oh,
and how to recognize them, how to verify them. I mean, it is a problem, you know. I mean, not, I don't want to say vast, but it's one of those things where, you know, if it happens once, that's too much. You know,
once
will result in a, like, devastating lawsuit. So, you know, even if it's rare, you want to be on the lookout for it. I've never, knock on wood, thank God, never encountered that. But you're mindful of it, you know. But I've had people obviously lie to me and give me, you know, you know, convey things that turn out not to be true and were designed to, you know, torpedo somebody.
Right.
And so the technology helps and it hurts. And the way it helps it hurts is because there are also databases and things out there that can help you verify certain things, like, you know, who's this person I'm talking to? What's this phone number that I'm getting this phone call from, you know, to verify, you know, who you're talking to and whether what they're saying is, you know, potentially true. So, and also with online court records, it makes things a little more accessible in terms of, you know, finding out, you know, criminal backgrounds. So the technology helps and it hurts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess what comes to mind for me in terms of how, what a reckless story can do, how it hurts not only the individual, but also the news outlet, is that, you know, the whole Covington Catholic school kids, you know, after the March for Life, when they were approached by the Native American gentleman, and Nick Sandman, who was the young man who was just sort of standing there and was approached by this gentleman. And of course, you know, he's an awkward 15-year-old and he kind of smirks because he didn't know what to do.
Right.
I mean, I think he, you know, they call him, the joke is now he's the highest paid correspondent at CNN because CNN ran with this story, and his parents filed a libel suit and had a very, from what I understand, a quite massive settlement. And I believe the similar, because the Washington Post and CNN in particular jumped out with pictures of him and created a narrative that was false and that was later proven to be demonstrably false. And so I So I guess since then I've read things now with more of a grain of salt than I would have even previously, because, you know, these pictures immediately, if stories go viral, like this particular one on Monsignor Burrell did, I happened to be at church when the story broke, and an hour later came out, and there were 18 messages on my cell phone. I thought, what on earth just happened? And so that very quickly, at least among Catholic media and people who work on Catholic issues, that went, Bob, I don't know how, at what point you heard about it, but it was, in the Catholic world, it was like a wildfire.
Yeah, and the Washington Post, you know, I believe it was them, called it a Rorschach test, you know, for Catholics.
Oh, right,
and,
right. I saw that, yeah.
You know, so there's very strong sentiment on both sides. And
yeah.
if you'll allow me to kind of mention one thing that kind
please,
of
comes to mind, yes.
that Mary and I, that you and I spoke of a little bit previously, was, you know, I'm you know, as a journalist, I'm just, you know, I'm very pro-transparency. And you know, the one thing that that jumped out at me from the articles was that, you know, the church was, you know, didn't, you know, they didn't talk, at least in some perspective. They met, they were going to talk, they were going to release a statement, and they weren't.
Right.
And, you know, so just, and I'm not, you know, judging that. I don't, like I said, I don't know all the,
right,
the contours of that.
Yeah,
but I would just
so
say,
few facts we know,
But it triggered something in my mind, you know, because I deal with the church all the time. And, you know, the lack of transparency and, frankly, in some ways, truth, you know, is a real problem. And it continues to be, you know, when dealing, as I investigate child sex abuse, you know, granted, you know, from a lot of it from years past, but still, you know, with information that's never really been explained or you know, fully talked about, you know, and I encounter really very aggressive opposition all the time from the church in terms of, you know, just talking and
right.
answering questions.
Yeah, you've mentioned that frustration,
you know,
before. Yeah.
And it's, you know, and more than frustration, I just don't think it's, you know, I just think that, you know, an institution that, you know, talks about truth, you know, in the end, it's like just, I don't know. That's been something I've encountered quite a bit from this archdiocese to many religious orders, and
yeah.
probably most.
Yeah, you've mentioned that.
So that's just an observation.
That's important. I mean, if we're not being transparent ourselves, you know, we certainly can't be held, you know, trying to hold other secular media outlets to a similar standard.
Right. And Bob, I really want to thank you as in your role as reporter. I know that I have had sex cases, and it was the local reporter that kept on the story, that kept the case in the forefront of our office. And truly, you know, your goal of transparency from everybody, from the church, from the local state's attorney's offices, all of the places, you are only helping the victim and those that are in whatever organization has been not transparent in bringing forward these allegations that then result in charges and hopefully in removal and conviction where appropriate. And so I personally want to thank you, because the work that you do is a mission. It is a vocation, and you are a blessing to all of us for the work that you do.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Well, and Bob, I think I can't think of a better way to end it. We're going to go to our break, but thank you so much again. Bob Hergerth from the Chicago Sun-Times, longtime investigative reporter and journalism ethics teacher on the side to many, many young journalists up and coming, have had the advantage of Bob's training and his expertise. So, Bob, thank you again, and thank your family for allowing you to be with us for this time while you're on a family vacation. We hope it's a wonderful and relaxing time for you all.
Thanks much.
All right. All right. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll have Teresa Farnan, who will talk with us about some of the aspects of this story from a Catholic moral perspective. This is Mary Fiorito and Loretta Freilich sitting in for Father Anthony on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Koska Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic, social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Koska Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststandschicago.org. ststandschicago.org.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Koska Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. It's not too late to register for the 2021-2022 school year at St. Stan's. Seats are limited. For more information or to schedule a tour, call 773-278-4560.
773-278-4560. And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Koska is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Koska is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. There are two new books from EWTN Publishing, Grace Explained by Father Brian Milady and Finding Frassati by Christine Wohar. In Grace Explained, Father Brian Milady provides one of the clearest and most luminous explanations of grace ever written, employing the same everyday Catholic language that has made him so popular as an EWTN radio host and retreat master. And Finding Frassati, Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, is identified as the man of the eight Beatitudes and recognized as one of the most fascinating and relatable saintly examples of the 20th century. Author Christine Wohar has created a practical guide to Frassati's short but spirited life. Grace Explained and Finding Frassati, available now at EWTNRC.com. By Catholic, shop EWTNRC.com.
And welcome back. This is Mary Helen Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony, along with my co-host, Loretta Frelick. And if you are just joining us, we are going to be talking today about some sensitive topics. So if there's a little one in the car with you, or you've got the kitchen radio on while you're doing some housework and you have little ears around, I would suggest that you switch to something else and come back and listen to the podcast later, because we're talking about some uncomfortable topics. But we are pleased to be joined for the second half of the conversation by Teresa Farnan, who is the author of Get Out Now, Why You Should Pull Your Children from Public Schools Before It's Too Late, which she co-wrote with her sister, Mary Rice Hassan. Also, Where Did I Come From? Where Am I Going? How Do I Get There? Which she wrote with her father, Dr. Charles Rice. She's a founding member of the Person and Identity Project that provides theological resources about the church's teaching on gender. She has taught at St. Paul's Seminary in Pittsburgh, at the Franciscan University of Steubenville, at Mount St. Mary's Seminary, and has also worked in the diaconate formation program for the dioceses of Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, and is a consultant to the bishops, the USCCB, the Committee on Laity, Marriage, and Family Life. And Teresa, I'm so grateful that you can be here with us. She is also, most importantly, the wife to Mike and the mother of 10 beautiful children. So, Teresa, thank you so much. We're so pleased to have you with us for the second half of this show about a very important yet delicate topic.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me on. And I should mention, too, in addition, the bio made me sound probably more impressive than I am, but I did collaborate with a number of other seminary professors on a project entitled, we wrote a paper that was published in a book on the church's response to sexual abuse. And the project was about seminaries and their response to sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And that actually does bring on this issue because Monsignor Burrell, before he was the point person for the USCCB, also worked in formation at the North American College.
Wow.
I think that's
I wasn't aware of that. Yes. And now I've been following this closely, Teresa, and I was not even aware of that.
Well, Teresa, mm-hmm. this is Mary's co-host, Loretta, and I just want to tell you, you had me at awesome at 10 children, so all the extra is absolutely fabulous.
But I'm so glad. You know, one of the reasons I thought of you, Teresa, because I know you have done so much seminary work and so much formation work, but also that, you know, you've been a consultant with the United States Catholic Bishops Conference and so have a sense of the importance of Monsignor Burrell's position and why it is that his fall from grace, as it were, is of such critical importance to Catholics, but especially to lay Catholics like us who have children who attend Catholic schools.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, this whole episode is just... The USCCB almost seems paralyzed by this information, as do the dioceses that are getting the information. The Diocese of Newark, for example, was given information by the Pillar. The Vatican was given information by the Pillar. And I have to ask, I expected, following everything that came out about McCarrick in 2018, that at that point, dioceses and seminaries would have addressed the use of hookup apps among their seminarians. I'm still astonished, but I guess what explains why they didn't was because the person who was in charge of the response was himself a user of hookup apps.
Right. Yeah. Who had an opportunity to meet with the Pope. So, quite frankly, his misconduct, in my opinion, it goes all the way to Francis. How the heck is the Pope allowing a man who uses hookup apps that now we find out, but how the heck is the Pope allowing himself to be meeting with this Monsignor with these kinds of problems following everything Vigano reported to us about McCarrick? I'm confused.
Honestly, you know, to back up a little bit, there was an attitude following the Second Vatican Council. There was a little bit of a debate over what the nature and meaning of celibacy is.
Yeah, can you explain Teresa, for people who don't understand the difference between your vow of celibacy and your promise of chastity?
Sure. Well, chastity would be preserving continence in the state to which God calls you, right?
So right.
Perfect.
So we can't cheat on our husbands, right? So that's...
Correct. Yeah. Correct. The chaste wife is someone who reserves herself for a relationship just with her husband. A priest observes the chastity by, living out his vocation in a chaste way where he gives himself unreservedly to the service of the people of Christ. Right. And so in order to be chaste, the definition I always use for my kids for chastity is the love that frees you from is the virtue that frees love from selfishness, right? Okay. So someone who is a chaste person isn't going to use people. You're not going to use someone else as an object of your pleasure, you know. So it frees you, even within your marriage, even within your vocation from the church, in order to be able to give yourself wholeheartedly. Celibacy is the vow that priests take, where they promise that they are going to forego any kind of sexual intimacy in order to give themselves unreservedly to this relationship with the church. And of course, to be a chaste priest means that you are going to embrace that vocation of living celibacy and giving yourself in this unreserved way with your body and your soul, getting up in the middle of the night, for instance, to do sick calls, using every paternal impulse that you have in order to make your parish more fruitful and so that it can flourish, right? And so in order to live your vow of celibacy, you must have this virtue of chastity.
Correct.
Right? So chastity is the celibacy is the state. And you must have this. You have to be someone who's capable of chaste living, which means, you know, of course, you're going to be living in a manner that's appropriate to this vow, right? So celibacy is that discipline that Catholic priests engage that they embrace as they can give themselves to the church unreservedly. They have to be able to be someone who is able to master master your passions and master your love. Now, in this case with Monsignor, so well, let me back up.
Right.
Following the Second Vatican Council, there was a movement within the church to interpret the vow of celibacy as merely giving up marriage.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Meant that this homosexual subculture seemed to develop because, wink, wink, nod, nod, it didn't involve women. And I think that's
And it didn't involve marriage. And it didn't involve marriage.
It didn't involve marriage. So as long as you gave up being married, you were celibate, right?
Right.
And that idea has sort of been percolating with the, and the way it's really permeated the culture of the church is that there's a tendency on the part of other priests, even good priests, to look at a priest who engages in sexual misconduct and to see it as a one-time fall from grace, an oops moment, right?
Right.
And to sort of give that person the benefit of the doubt. Oh, they'll get back to it. Oh, well, you know, men have needs. And to just kind of turn a blind eye to it. And so, you know, the criticism, I think, of Pope Francis that has dogged his papacy and that really has been a problem for the Vatican throughout this century is that there has been a tendency to give up the benefit of the doubt to priests who engage in sexual misconduct. And we finally got to the point, I think, after the scandals in 2002, where we entered into zero tolerance with respect to sexual activity with minors. But I'll tell you what, the McCarrick issue was not just about minors. It was about a bishop who preyed on seminarians.
Right. Yes.
Right. And in fact, yeah, the majority of his victims, I think, were actually not minors. And you probably saw in the papers, Teresa, he's now been criminally charged in Massachusetts. And Loretta is a former state prosecutor and prosecuted a lot of sex crimes against children. So she's better versed at this than I am, but in Massachusetts, because they have a particular part of their sexual abuse of minors criminal statute, unfortunately for McCarrick, when he left the state, the clock stopped ticking, which means at the age of 91, he can still be criminally charged for a crime that I believe happened 30 years ago, but it's still... and he is going to be charged, and I don't know, it'll depend if he even lives long enough, you know, depending on how quickly they move, if he'll actually see any prison time, but he very well may die in prison because of it.
What really truly broke my heart was when I read the McCarrick report, and the story is of the seminarian who was there at his beach house, who finds out the only bed available is McCarrick's, and he breaks down and cries in front of his fellow seminarians because he knows what's going to happen. And so really, it's horrendous that it happened to anyone, but that just brings it home that, you know, this is something they need to just rout out of the church because the church is rotten at the core if this is what's happening.
Well, and the other issue, though, is that some of the people who are attacking the journalist at the Pillar have been harping on the fact that somehow this is just a hookup act. And in their mind, it's almost like they seem to parse out McCarrick because his victims were vulnerable seminarians, whereas this is a hookup act where people sort of use each other for mutual pleasure. And I don't care. Like, that still is not, that still is looking at someone else and taking advantage of even if someone, it's not okay, it's never okay in the church
never okay.
to use someone, whether or not they give their consent. Like, our standard is not consent.
It's never okay to use another person for your own pleasure.
Well,
never.
Well, to that point, you know, I was so, and Teresa, you know, you and I, Loretta's not on Twitter yet. I'm trying to talk her into it. She's probably wisely ignoring my request.
Prosecutors don't go on Twitter
and
Facebook.
She keeps telling me that she's going to get targeted by one of her.
I don't want any criminals finding out about me.
Someone she put behind bars when they get out coming to look for her. But this is like a Law and Order episode, Loretta. But at any rate, I was just appalled by some of what I saw with that, what I would describe as left-of-center Catholic media, one of whom compared in a tweet Monsignor Burrell to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, suffering because he had been outed this way. And the best response I saw to this was actually in the Los Angeles Blade, which is a LGBTQ newspaper for Southern California. And let me just read you this and the author of this, what I presume is kind of an op-ed piece. The headline is Powerful Anti-LGBTQ Priest Caught on Gay Sex App at Work. And he says, Jeffrey Burrell used Grindr for years, often every day. for its intended purpose, to have sex with other men. Gay men don't use Grindr to talk about the weather. We don't use it to idly chat. We use it to have sex. That's what it's for. Gay men don't go to the Entourage and other gay bathhouses to have a steam and a cup of tea. Gay men go to the Entourage for only one reason, to have sex with other men. That's not innuendo. It's reality. It's the truth. So stop playing silly games, liberal Catholic press. Jeffrey Burrell, the highest-ranking Catholic priest in the United States who was not a bishop, has been having sex with men for years on purpose, on a regular basis, and often while traveling on the church's dime. So he really called out twice, two or three times in this, and you go to losangelesblade.com and you can read the whole article, several times, furious with the liberal Catholic press trying to paint this guy as a martyr.
And there, and what's also important is what Mary talked about in the Blade opinion, but in the Pillars investigation report, they say they interviewed Father Thomas Berg, a professor of moral theology at St. Joseph's Seminary in Yonkers, New York, and he said that it's the use of this hookup app is inconsistent with clerical obligations to continence and chastity. And he further goes on to say, when it becomes evident that a cleric is regularly and glaringly failing to live continence, that can become only one step away from sexual predation.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and if you remember, the Vatican instructions on whether or not someone who has same-sex tendencies or attraction can become a priest, definitely, while it sets the bar, I mean, there is a loophole where they say, well, maybe if you're an adolescent and you experience some kind of transitory attraction as part of your sexual or affective development, your emotional affective development, you cannot be ordained if you have acted on it, and you definitely cannot be ordained if you have, number one, deep-seated homosexual tendencies, and number two, you support gay culture. So both of these criteria have been violated regularly by Monsignor Burrell. So again, I come back to the fact that here we have this man who was in formation at the North American College, who, as it turns out, was addicted to the use of this app that is used only for sexual encounter.
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad you raised that adjective, addicted, Teresa, because I understand that maybe the underlying motivation of the left of center Catholic press was to have sympathy for someone who was very publicly shamed, but the area in which I seem, where I find myself feeling sympathetic, is that it seems clear to me that he does have a real addiction. If he was using that Grindr app every day,
yes,
and he was compulsively using it from work, I know a number of people who work in IT security, all of whom have told me, no one using that app could have a realistic expectation of privacy. It's not how it works. Those apps are notoriously porous in terms of being able to, you know, find out identities and churn up data on people. But someone, it's, I guess it's one thing if this is, as you mentioned, someone who is an occasional slip up, you know, of either orientation, and then repents and, you know, is not someone who is compulsively erring against their vows and against the expectations that the, as Cardinal George once said, people rightly have a higher expectation of priests.
Amen.
That it's their right to do so. It's just that they do so. But this, it does seem to me, this wasn't just, you know, compulsive and addictive behavior, but it was really reckless. That's how much his addiction must have been pushing him. Do you have any kind of, like, you know, when you were teaching at seminary and working in seminary formation, you know, are there ways that men were kind of trained or taught to sort of work through these sorts of things?
Honestly, this would have been something, I think, where this would have been the kind of issue, especially, I mean, if you saw addictive behavior, this is someone who does not belong in the seminary. And
right.
I was, you know, especially when I was at Mount St. Mary's Seminary, I think this would have been the occasion for someone to sit down and have a long discussion with that seminarian. There are people who come in to the seminary who have been wounded before they get there. And in particular, there are a lot of people who come in who have, a lot of people in our culture, let's face it, a lot of men walking around with father wounds, with dysfunctional family paths. And I'll tell you what, in the seminary, there is a lot of effort made to provide people with the counseling that they need so that you can become, you know, humanly whole.
Yes.
Before you even get to the point of ordination.
Right.
And the point is you're supposed to be able to detect and discern this before that person is ordained, because otherwise it is really truly just a ticking time bomb.
Right.
But obviously, like Monsignor Burrell went through in the late 1990s, I think the attitude at that time, if I remember correctly, and I was not teaching at that time, I was still in school, but following a lot of this, I think the attitude at that time was, well, priests who have same-sex attraction, even if it's a deep-seated tendency, can still be ordained as long as they will observe celibacy.
Right.
And so it was looser standard, which probably would have carried over into his own formation. He would have internalized that message. Like, it's okay if I have this attraction as long as I don't act on it, right? Which is the same thing with Vatican instruction in 2005, where if you have a deep-seated tendency, you should not be ordained.
Yeah, and
right?
what's the rationale behind that, Teresa, that about the deep-seated tendency?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, number one, the whole nature of someone giving himself or a priestly ordination is that you're called to fatherhood and you're called to the spousal relationship with the church. And in order to be able to do that, what you're doing is you're giving up your forsaking, you know, wife, family, and everything else. But you have to be capable of a certain, I think the rationale is that there is a level of affective maturity that is called for, where rather than being somebody who is still working through some of these issues in the past that have led you to a homosexual lifestyle, you're able to give yourself with no reservation, right? And so you are able to enter into that fatherly relationship. You know, one of the most powerful voices in the church on this is the writer, and I'm probably going to pronounce his name wrong, Joseph Ciambra.
I'm familiar with him.
He is really, really powerful, because his point is, he says, for so long he would go to the church and he was assured that it was okay, you know, almost like, well, God made you with same-sex attraction. And really, the way that we look at this should be that sex is something that is given to the person for the sake of the family, right? In other words, orientation, we all get distracted into orientation and desires, but sex is a gift that's given to men so that they, with a woman, can have a family. And someone who is entering the priesthood is called to take that desire to give life and put it in the service of the church in a way where he's able to master his passions and focus on being a father to his parish, right? And so as soon as you get caught up into, you know, discussions of orientation and is this orientation or that orientation okay, you sort of lose sight that the whole point is that you've integrated yourself so much that you're capable of this kind of chastity.
Well, Teresa, we thank you so much for being on the show. Your insight is incredible. And as we all know, wounded people wound if they are not healed. So the real challenge is that the church forgives. You can be angry, hold these men accountable, but we must forgive them and not allow the wound of that to carry further into our lives and our church. So we thank you so much for all that you have brought to today's show. God bless you.
Teresa, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. You'll have to come back on. This went by way too quickly.
Yeah, oh my gosh. All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks so much. This has been Mary Fiorito and Loretta Fralick sitting in today for Father Anthony with our guest Teresa Farnan. Have a great week. Goodbye and God bless you.
Can you see the winds have changed? Marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. Read the signs, no time to hide.